I don't know how many folks we might have in the congregation this morning who are boaters, spending some time on the water. I've never owned a boat. I've never wanted to, but I have enjoyed the friendships of people who own boats. I don't know in your experience if you've ever spent much time on the water, whether out in the Gulf or over in the Atlantic, whether you have ever been out on the water during a storm. I have not, but as I've talked with some of my friends who have, what they describe for me can be an ominous, frightening experience, even to the most experienced sailors. We all remember the incident in Mark chapter 4 when they were crossing the Sea of Galilee at night, and Jesus was asleep up in the front of the boat, and all of a sudden a strong wind came up and the boat was taking on water, and the disciples, who were not novices, as some of them were fishermen, were so frightened, they awakened Jesus because they were concerned that they were going to die. It can be frightening out on the water. Well, this next chapter in the historical account of the Apostle Paul's travels finds him on a voyage that becomes quite perilous. And where we left off 2 weeks ago is we had just ended Acts chapter 26, where King Agrippa says to the governor Festus, after hearing Paul's defense, the third defense he gives before governing officials, they said, you know, he said he wanted to go to Caesar, and Caesar he'll go, although probably he didn't need to go at all. He's probably innocent. But because he appealed to Caesar, it kind of set in place the fact that he would be going to Rome. And so we pick up with chapter 27, and I'll begin reading in verse 1. And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in an Adramidian ship, which was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. And the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. And from there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra and Lycia. And there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. And when we had sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty had arrived off of Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go farther, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salamine. And with difficulty sailing past it, we came to a certain place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. And when considerable time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them. And he said to them, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. And when a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had gained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete close in shore. Well, we see that the Apostle Paul issues a storm warning. And it comes not very long after they have set sail for Rome. You'll notice, and I've pointed this out before, but it's time to point it out again, that in Luke's account we find the pronoun in verse 1, it was decided that we should sail for Italy. So Luke is with Paul and one other man, Aristarchus, a fellow believer from Thessalonica. And as we've gone through the travels of Paul, we find at times Luke using the pronoun we and at times using the pronoun they, because Luke would come and go and was not with Paul constantly. But on this being transported to Rome to have an audience with Caesar, Luke is with them. So what he's giving here is a firsthand eyewitness account on his part. And as was typically true of any prisoner being transported to Rome, Paul is accompanied by Julius, who is a Roman centurion. And just to remind ourselves for a moment, with the picture here on the screen, of the kind of man that was with Paul. He was his guard. But one thing about Julius that we find a couple of times throughout this episode is the fact that he pretty much had respect for Paul. He was not oblivious to the fact that the man was probably not guilty, that he had been through these audiences with two governors and with a king. And I'm sure they must have said to him, "You're transporting this man to Rome, but chances are he's innocent and doesn't really need to go." But nonetheless, it says in verse 3 that he was respectful, he was kind to Paul, he allowed him to have friends to come and visit. So as we think about Paul being in custody, we need to understand this as a rather flexible custody. He is accountable to this Roman soldier. I guess this is a Roman soldier who's trying to pass the scanner going into Rome. I'm not sure. But what happens is they start off on one ship, and they go so far, and then they transfer to a bigger ship, an Alexandrian ship, which is headed for Italy. And that's probably because the Alexandrian ship coming from Egypt is a grain ship. Later on in this account, down in verse 38, we read that as they're trying to jettison stuff off the ship, that they throw off all the wheat. So that's why we know this was a grain ship. It was transporting wheat. And indeed, Egypt was the major source of grain for the city of Rome. Now, the ship that Paul would have been sailing on would have been this one. I'm just trying to see if you're paying attention. Seriously, this would be very much a replica of the kind of ship. See, if you were a little drowsy, that woke you up a little bit, didn't it? But this would have been the kind of ship that he was on. Luke tells us later in this account the precise number of people on the ship on this voyage, and it was 276. So they set out, and they encounter rough sailing. Now, if I could just show you for a moment, what we've read so far is they started from Sidon, and they have sailed up, and you can see the red here where they're falling. There's Myra, and they are going to be switching to another ship, the Alexandrian ship, that'll take them on to Italy. Now, it's rough sailing. I don't know if you picked up on it as I read you the account in verses 1 to 13, but we said in verse 4, Luke describes the winds as contrary. Verse 7, they sailed slowly many days. They arrived at Cnidus with difficulty. And if you can't see from where you're sitting, Cnidus is right here. They arrived there with difficulty. And verse 8, he says they came to Salamine with difficulty. And then verse 9 says that the voyage is now dangerous. So all along the way, they are not finding smooth sailing. As a result, Paul offers his advice. Now, maybe you think it strange that Paul, a landlubber, would be saying anything to the pilot of the ship or the captain, which is probably the owner of the ship and the pilot of the ship, and the centurion. But keep in mind that by the time Paul takes this journey, if we follow the chronology very closely, he has already traveled over 3,500 miles on 11 different voyages before this, just with all of his missionary travels and his other travels. So he is perhaps as experienced as anybody out on the open seas in a ship. And so he gives the serious forecast in verse 10 and says, you know, if we continue on this way, it's a good chance we're going to lose the ship, we're going to lose the cargo, we're going to lose our very own lives. Well, when Julius confers with the pilot and the captain, they decide that they want to push ahead. They had come to a place called Fair Havens. This is the island of Crete, and they had come around, and here's Salamine that we mentioned. They have come around to the south side, hoping to get some protection from the island to their north. Here is Fair Havens right here. Now, Fair Havens sounds exotic, and in fact, it even kind of looks exotic. That's the way it looks today. But the fact of the matter is, Fair Havens was not an ideal spot to winter. And in fact, that's what's motivating the pilot, the captain, and several of the others. In fact, it's a majority vote that says, no, let's press on. They want to see if they can't get as far as Phoenix, which is over here, about another 40 miles away. Apparently, it was much more ideal to make it to Phoenix if they're going to have to spend the winter somewhere. Fair Havens, from the little bit of reading I've done, not only was it not the best protection for the ship as Phoenix would have been, but it was kind of a backwater place. It was probably the tourist bureau that gave it the name. I mean, because it's kind of a misnomer to call it Fair Havens. A lot of times, perhaps you've experienced where you are going someplace as a tourist and you find something has an exotic name, and when you get there, it's really not all that exotic. I remember many years ago, back in the 70s, I was serving as the president of the Alumni Association for our seminary. And we had meetings once or twice a year, typically up on the campus. But an elderly couple had passed away and left in their will a motel to the seminary. And it was located in Frostproof, Florida. Now, obviously, it got the name because they bragged about the weather and that, you know, you never had to worry about a freeze if you were in that part of South Florida. So they said, we're going to have our next board meeting down in Frostproof, Florida. What a dive. Oh, I'm sorry if you're from the area, but I mean, I think one blinking traffic light, a very small community, way out of the way, and the motel had seen its better days. We didn't go back there a second time. But Fair Havens was sort of the Frostproof, you know, of Crete. So they do decide to make a run for it. And this is where the account really becomes perilous, because they do encounter a storm. And verses 14 to 44 describe this whole experience. I'm not going to read all the verses to you, but I will read selected portions. Follow along as I read verses 14 to 19. But before very long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind called Euroquillo. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. And running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. And after they had hoisted it up, this is the little dinghy or lifeboat that they're pulling behind, towing behind the ship. And after they had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Syrtis, they let down the sea anchor, and so let themselves be driven along. The next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. So the first thing we see here is that cargo is abandoned. Now, this wind that he calls the Euroquillo is actually a kind of a hybrid word from a Greek word and a Latin word. The Greek word Euros means east wind, and the Latin word Aquilo means north wind. And so these north and east winds came together, much like we would call up in New England a nor'easter. That's what this is the equivalent of, that comes rushing down from the mountainous parts of Crete down across the water, and this ship is in its path. To look more carefully at the language that Luke uses so we get the sense of how ferocious the storm was, he says that the wind was, and the word he uses is tuphonikos. It's from the word tuphon, where we get our English word typhoon. This was a massive storm that they encountered. And it's so massive that as I read it there, you probably didn't count them, but we could see in order what their actions were to survive. First, they tried to get in the shelter of the small island, Clauda. Next, they used supporting cables. And probably what they did, as they often did in ancient times, is take cables and actually put them under the ship and tie them so it would keep the timbers together so the hull would not give way. Other times, I think from the description here, that's what they did, but something else they did in ancient times is they would tie a cable from the bow to the stern to help give strength to the ship so the back of the ship wouldn't be broken in a storm. Third, they let down either it's the sea anchor or the main sail, but probably the sea anchor to help kind of drag along to slow them down. Then they jettisoned the cargo, and finally it says they were throwing even the ship's tackle and equipment overboard. That's how desperate the situation is. So the cargo is abandoned, but also we read in verse 20, "And since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on, all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned." So you've got experienced sailors, you've got prisoners, you've got soldiers, you've got 276 people who have collectively, as they have battled this for several days, have concluded, there is no hope. We are lost. The somber reality sunk in that they were going to sink, that they were staring death in the face. So the Mayday, Mayday, SOS efforts, not literally, but I'm speaking metaphorically, all those efforts had come to naught. There was despair. And despair always sets in when there's no hope. And we know that to be true whether you're being pummeled by the winds and the waves on the ocean or whether you're being pummeled by the winds and the waves of hardship and trial and tribulation in this life. We have all kinds of storms in our lives that are not the literal storms on the high seas. And when we get to a point where we're confronting a storm in our life where there's no hope, then despair ultimately sets in. And that happens with these travelers. Then we have what to me out of this whole account is perhaps the most dramatic moment, because a calm comes. There's a calm in the storm. And the calm is not a calm of the wind and the waves, but it's a calm of the heart and the mind. And the dramatic moment comes because Paul stands up in front of these 275 people, 276 including himself, and look what he says in verses 21 to 26. "And when they had gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in their midst and said, 'Men, you ought to have followed my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss.'" Ouch. I don't think Paul intended it to be, I told you so. It kind of sounds that way. I think he was at least doing this, trying to establish credibility and authority. "I warned you this was going to happen. Indeed it has. So since you didn't listen to me then, perhaps you will listen to me now. If you had listened to my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss." Verse 22. "And yet now I urge you to keep up your courage, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood before me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on a certain island.'" So Paul boldly stands up in the midst of this ship that's being tossed to and fro in this terrible storm, and he addresses them and he shares with them that he's had an angelic revelation. And the revelation he's had from this angel is not a single person on this ship is going to lose their life. Twice, he says, in verses 22 and verse 25, twice he says, keep up your courage. I think that it is often true that people in normal life circumstances might scoff and be disinterested when someone talks about the supernatural or about God or trusting God. But if you put people in certain situations where there is the threat to life and there's imminent danger, it's interesting how more attentive people can be. I think that if he had said to them in a different setting about having an angelic revelation, I think some of them would have laughed him off. But we don't read anything here in this account with what's going on. I think that they were hanging on to his every word. Why? He was giving them a word of hope. He was encouraging them to hang in there, to stay with it, that he had heard from God that none of them were going to die. Paul's encouragement to these shipmates, his encouragement, his words to them, contain truths that provide encouragement to you and me during the times of storms of our lives. What did he say to them? Well, in verse 23, he said, first of all, that he belonged to God. Notice how he said that? I like the way it kind of rolled off of his lips. An angel of the God to whom I belong. He belongs to God. How do we belong to God? Well, we're given several pictures in the New Testament. We belong to God the way a bride belongs to the bridegroom. Christ is the bridegroom. The church is his bride. We're also told in the New Testament that we belong to God in the same way that a child belongs to his father, which is why we call out with that affectionate title, Abba, Father, that endearing quality that he's my father, I'm his child. And then, of course, there is the belonging of the sheep to the shepherd, that we are a part of his flock, and that every one of us matters to him, so much so that Jesus gave the one parable of leaving the 99 to go search for the one. So he expressed that he belonged to God. That should give encouragement to us when we're in the storms of life, that, hey, you know what? I belong to God. But then Paul went on to say that not only does he belong to this God, but that he serves him. Paul had been told by God that he would stand before Caesar and that all of his fellow travelers would live. And so as one who was serving God, Paul was confident of this very thing, and I hope this is your confidence, that when we are walking with God and serving God, I don't know who this quote is attributable to, but I remember hearing it many, many times when I was a young Christian, that the man of God is indestructible until God's purpose for his life has been fulfilled. The man of God, the woman of God, is indestructible until God's purposes for that life has been completed. And so regardless of how dangerous and how ominous it appeared, Paul stood confident that he served God and that he also believed in God's sovereignty. And he said in verse 25, I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I've been told. And then, oh, by the way, verse 26, we're going to run aground on an island. I mean, so he had to add that. We're all going to live, but we are going to be shipwrecked before we're done here. Now, if I could just summarize a little bit. In verses 27 to 32, as they're going along, they sense that they're near land, so they start doing soundings. And sure enough, the bottom is getting more and more shallow, so they know they're approaching some kind of a shoreline. So it says that they dropped four more anchors in order to slow them down to avoid hitting any rocks that might be near this shore. But then something kind of ugly happens. This little lifeboat that had been hanging on, some of the sailors try to lower the lifeboat and escape and leave the ship. And so what does Paul do? He gets wind of it. He goes to Julius. He goes to the centurion and tells him, they're trying to make a run for it and leave the rest of us. None of us will be saved if they leave the ship. And so Julius immediately orders that the lifeboat be cut loose, and so it's cut loose, and it floats off before these sailors can get on and abandon ship. But then Paul encourages them again. Look at verses 33 to 36. And until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you have been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation. For not a hair from the head of any of you shall perish." And having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it and began to eat. And all of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. Again, what a dramatic moment. He says, you guys need to eat. You're weak. I'm sure they've been throwing up. I'm sure they're dehydrated. And so he stands up, and by example, he eats and thanks God for the food and assures them that not a single hair of their head is going to be harmed. And so twice more, we find him encouraging them. Well, going on down, verses 38 to 41, they end up throwing the wheat overboard. They throw more anchors overboard. They're headed for the beach. They get stuck on a reef. The ship gets lodged there, and it says then the waves start pummeling it, and it starts breaking apart. So this is where, again, Julius steps up and exercises incredible concern and kindness toward Paul. Pick up with me at verse 42. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners that none of them should swim away and escape, which was typical Roman practice. That rather, because you were responsible for prisoners, and if they're going to get away, it's better to kill them than let them get away as the ship is breaking up. Verse 43. But the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest should follow, some on planks and others on various things from the ship, and thus it happened that they all were brought safely to land. So they all make it exactly as Paul had told them. It's like something out of a movie, yeah, which, by the way, I've read in more than one place. Several scholars acknowledge, not just in biblical literature, but in all of classical literature, this is the most detailed account of a sea voyage in all of classical literature. I mean, I've skipped some parts. Go back and read it all on your own before the day is out. For the sake of time this morning, I've summarized some parts. But Luke gives incredible minute detail. It's so detailed that liberal scholars who've tried to question whether this incident ever happened, it seemed like an exaggerated way to make Paul look like a Superman. I mean, you wouldn't believe some of the things that people write. But the fact is, only someone who had seen this could provide this kind of detailed information. So Luke was there at Paul's elbow and saw all of this transpire. But, you know, as we step back and look at this event, I really do see the bridge, you know, to our lives and our day, because there's some things that have not changed, particularly that as Christians we can find ourselves in situations where we can step up and minister to unbelievers in the midst of tragedy or crisis. And as I said before, such times can make non-Christians unusually attentive. Remember the famous incident that happened last year about the 33 miners in Chile that were 2 miles underground when there was a mine collapse? They were trapped down there for 69 days, and the whole world watched daily as these extraordinary efforts were made to save these men, which they did do. But interestingly, as a part of their survival down in the bowels of the earth, of the 33 miners, the oldest one, Mario Gomez, he was 63 years old. He, much like the Apostle Paul, kind of took a lead in one particular area. He helped them arrange an area to be a chapel, and he led in daily prayers, and he helped guide them in and minister to them in spiritually while they were waiting for the rescue that they hoped would come. And of course, their hope was fueled by the fact that once they got cameras down there and there was some communication with the surface, where 69 days is still 60, that's a long time to be stuck down under the earth. But it's interesting that this man stepped up and was able to play that role.
He almost became like a spiritual father to the other 32. There have been some times in my life, especially visiting people seriously in the hospital, where I have been praying with someone that I know, only to have someone on the other side of the curtain before I leave ask if I could come pray with their loved one. I don't even know them. They're strangers to me. But as they're laying there with and their loved ones with them, attending to them, and they're facing serious medical problems, and then hearing someone praying next to them, they're wanting at times the benefit of that. And as Christians, we should, I think, be looking for opportunities to step up and minister to unbelievers. And that's why in the wake of Katrina and a lot of these other tragedies of floods and of earthquakes and tornadoes, it's good and right that often you see it's the churches that are stepping up and are ministering to people's needs in those situations and speaking the gospel into people's lives. Perhaps some of you, there's so many stories that have been written through the years since the Titanic sunk, kind of brought to everyone's remembrance in this generation by the movie some years ago. But, you know, there was one man on the Titanic that really exemplifies this stepping up, much like Paul did, to minister in the midst of a crisis, and his name was John Harper. The year prior, he had been over to Moody Memorial Church and had done a three-month series of evangelistic messages. He was from Scotland. They had asked him to come back again and do another 3 months the next year. He was supposed to have booked passage on the Lusitania, but something in the schedule changed, and he booked passage on the Titanic instead. One survivor remembers on the deck, as people were abandoning the ship into lifeboats, that this man was standing there sharing the gospel with someone on the deck. He later ended up in the water floating on a piece of wreckage and happened to float up next to a man and said to him, "Are you saved?" And the man said, "I don't think so." And he said, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, you should be saved." Then the current kind of took him away, and then the current brought him back, and he asked the man again, "Are you saved yet?" And the man said, "No." And then the waves took him away again, and John Harper drowned. But that man lived and became a Christian. But again, here's a man who, in the midst of crisis, is ministering the gospel. And the Apostle Paul did that here in this situation. It's not been, I think, established with 100% certainty, but the Titanic incident has been made into movies at least three or four times. And one of the strongest stories that have come out of that whole tragedy was the fact that as the ship was going down, that the band was playing the hymn, "Nearer, My God, to Thee." And if you've seen the movie, that's, you know, what they're playing. But the story has come from a lot of the survivors that the band was playing a lot of songs to kind of help calm passengers. But even the musicians at that point were trying to bring some sense of calm in the midst of a terrible situation. One would hope that any Christian would step up to rise to the occasion, not just be cowering in the corner, wringing your hands like everyone else. That if we believe what we say we believe in a God who is sovereign and all-powerful, and if we believe that this life is not all there is, then yes, we do have a word of hope that many others have not yet heard. I would hope we wouldn't be like, I don't know if you've heard the little story about the plane that realized their landing gear wasn't working, so the pilot came on and said, "Everyone needs to prepare for a crash landing. This is a serious situation. The airport's prepared for us." And one woman just finally yelled out, as there was somewhat of a panic on the plane, "Somebody do something religious." And a guy stood up and said, "Let's take an offering." Hopefully you'd come up with a better response than that. But let me show you here what we've been talking about. I know that some of you are more visual, and I think this will help for us to get a sense of the whole. Should I give you this? Okay. Go back. It's got the storm has survived, Roman numeral 3, so I should go back. There. Tell you, while you're working with that, Dan, I'm just going to go on here with some additional comments, because it'll be just as helpful at any point that we can show that. But we see as we come to chapter 28, verses 1 to 10, that the storm is survived. Okay. If you follow the line here, it's, isn't that neat? It's moving. That's where they're being tossed around. Yeah. Actually, I'm gonna replay this in just a moment. But remember, they started in Sidon, and they end up shipwrecking over here in Malta. And then next week, we'll find our way on the way up to Rome. But to show you again the places, and it lights up each of the places where they've been, I'll do it one more time so you can follow it. Oh, so I shouldn't. This is too cool. I've got to do it again. I watched this at home about 10 times. I know I'm a little slow on the technology, but... No. So that's the voyage that we've been talking about this morning. Now, I need to go up here if I understood my directions correctly. So I'm okay? Okay. We've got time. Let's read this, the first 10 verses of Acts 28. And when they had been brought safely through, then we found out that the island was called Malta. And the natives showed us extraordinary kindness, for because of the rain that had set in and because of the cold, they kindled a fire and received us all. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and had laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. And when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they began saying to one another, "Undoubtedly this man is a murderer, and though he has been saved from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." However, he shook the creature off into the fire and suffered no harm. But they were expecting that he was about to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had waited a long time, and had seen nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and began to say that he was a god. People are fickle. This guy must be some kind of a criminal. He's killed somebody, and now he's going to get what he deserves. Oh, he must be a god. He didn't die from the snake bite. Verse 7, now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the leading man of the island named Publius, who welcomed us and entertained us courteously 3 days. And it came about that the father of Publius was lying in bed afflicted with recurrent fever and dysentery. And Paul went in to see him, and after he had prayed, he laid his hands on him and healed him. And after this had happened, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases were coming to him and getting cured. And they also honored us with many marks of respect, and when we were setting sail, they supplied us with all we needed. So, interestingly, the name Malta means refuge. So it literally is an island of refuge. And they're quite friendly to them, as we've read in verses 1 and 2. And then we find that here Paul receives deliverance, knowing the island and assuming they know their snakes. They saw that it was a poisonous snake that had bitten Paul, thus they were expecting him to die. But obviously God protected his life, and he survived it. It's also interesting that Paul here, he's just been through this harrowing experience, and he's walking around collecting sticks, helping to build the fire, which kind of, to me, reflects a servant's attitude on his part, that he was willing to be helping in that way. I think I'd have been over there trying to recover after what he's been through the previous 2 weeks. Incidentally, there's a lot of legends that always attach to these things. You find no poisonous snakes on the island of Malta today. And the legend on the island is that from the time that Paul was delivered from that poisonous snake bite, that from that point on, all poisonous snakes lost their poisonous venom. And that's why to this day, remember, this is legend, to this day why in Malta they don't have poisonous snakes, supposedly. But not only was Paul one who received deliverance, but he was able to minister deliverance to this very wealthy man who was a leader there in that island community. And apparently his father had been ill with a fever, which incidentally, there is a fever that's called the Malta fever. It is a fever that has afflicted people for centuries in Malta, at Gibraltar, and other places along the Mediterranean. And in the late 1800s, they actually identified the microorganism that was causing this fever. And it was coming from the Maltese goat's milk. And that's how these people were getting this fever. But it's interesting how it says here that it was recurrent, because even to this day, even though there's a vaccine, if you get this particular fever, it still will last 3 or 4 months, and for some people, 1 to 2 years before you totally get over it. That's likely what Publius's father was afflicted with, and Paul was able to lay hands on him and pray for him, and he was healed. And much like we've seen in our whole study of Acts with Paul and the other apostles, God enables them to have the ability to minister physical healing to people who are sick. So when word gets out about Publius's father, they were lining up at the door, as we would expect. Couple more shots. These are my last two visual aids. This is the harbor in Malta where they believe that they shipwrecked and were able to get ashore. This happens to be the name of the town. It's called St. Paul's Bay, for obvious reasons. This is the local flag of St. Paul's Bay. The blue and white curves represent the waves of the ocean coming up against the island there. The green snake represents the fact that Paul was bitten by a poisonous snake and did not die. The sword represents the way that Paul was executed, because he was beheaded. And, of course, on the hilt of the sword, you find the cross in the yellow. So to this day, they fly this flag all in remembrance of this particular incident. We've all heard of John Wesley, that he took a voyage to North America as a missionary, but unfortunately he had not been born again. He was very religious, very devout. After all, he was going to be a missionary to the people here in North America. And he was on a ship on the way over to North America when their ship encountered a violent storm. John Wesley wrote about this and spoke about it many times during his life, because it's a part of his testimony. And during this terrible storm, almost everybody on the ship was just terrified. In fact, many of the English immigrants were literally shrieking with fear in the midst of the storm, except for one group. There were a group of Moravian Christians from Germany. What were they doing in the hold of the ship? They were huddled together and they were singing hymns in the middle of the storm. And after the storm was over, Wesley went up to the leader of the Moravians and he asked them, "Were you not afraid?" And the man replied, "I thank God, no." And Wesley persisted, "But were not your women and children afraid?" "No," the man said, "our women and children are not afraid to die." And the calm that they demonstrated in that was the beginning. Wesley could never shake that. And so he eventually was led to an evangelical faith and was born again. But what sparked it was that he desired to have the kind of peace and security that those people demonstrated. So as we live our lives, we pray that we might be those agents of hope to someone who does not have the knowledge that you have, and to minister the gospel, even as Paul did, in an extraordinary situation.